welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming, author of the wonderful new book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Good day, Colin.
If this Kimball's a-rockin', don't come a-knockin'.
Exactly.
That's what they say up in Maine.
I actually have that on a very small, strategically placed tattoo.
Yeah, the infamous right buttock tattoo. I've heard about that.
Yeah, don't give it away, man. Oh, man. All right, we got
imagination. Imagination's a potent thing.
Oh my goodness, yes, I would say so. A lot on the plate today, but I want to begin with this. It's an interesting topic here, and it's the decline of televised sports ratings and the various reasons for it. But you have some ideas. What do you think's the cause of all of this?
I have one idea. You're the one with the multiplicity of ideas.
Oh, okay.
I've been waiting with bated breath for this. So go ahead, hit me.
Well, I think it's a number of things. We live in a highlight culture, and particularly younger sports fans don't have the patience to watch an entire game of any kind, and they don't watch TV. They're watching online, they're watching on phones. All they want to see are the highlights. And I think overall, you have fewer people watching anything. The numbers for all television networks and shows are down across the board. I think those are the biggest things, and I see it as that more than any weakness that might be inherent in any particular sport. What say you, sir?
That's not what I'm going to go with.
Okay.
It's not bad that I'm going to pitch to, because it is precipitous since COVID, right? That's when we have the giant decline, when you can see these numbers drop to levels they haven't been at in a long time. And I think it's this: our need to follow has replaced our ability to enjoy anything. We do things, we do not partake of things. Those are very different ideas. And I think people tune in and they see no one there. They don't feel like they are ensconced in this protective group womb that is so vital to everyone. People will not do things where they don't feel like everyone else is in on it. And something happens to the subconscious brain when you see a sport being played in front of nobody, an empty arena. Because I don't think people actually really like sports that much. I think people like very little in this life that much. And that's what you're seeing the walk-away result from all of this here. And it's like, for instance, a week or two ago, I had a couple pieces out, and they were, one of them was the number one trending thing on Facebook News, and the other was this front page trending thing on Google News. So that means like 10 million people are seeing what you do. But I don't have anyone talking about me. I don't have any support. I have the antithesis, really. So the result of that is not a single letter to my website, not a single new Twitter follower even. It's 10 million people. That's like 30 towns worth of people saw that, but they also picked up that no one was sharing it, talking about it, and what happens then is people just walk away.
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. I think there's some of that. I think in some sports, though, especially during the whole COVID thing, the quality was not there, and there was no predictability. Schedules would stop and start, and I don't know. I enjoyed watching the NBA. I actually liked not having the fans. I found it an interesting, intimate setting. But I think there's part of that. I think there are certainly those people who are more interested in being part of the crowd than they are actually watching. But that's not dissimilar to what I said. People don't watch. We have a short attention span culture these days, which, as you've pointed out, that people don't read. And that's one of the reasons why it's too much work to actually read a book.
Right, they might not have the attention spans, but the drop was so precipitous. With the you took the crowds away. I mean, the numbers are giant. For maybe not so much with the NFL, which only went down what, like 9% or something like that. But like the NBA was halved. That's not just like okay, the trending decline. There was something different about the year of removing the visual of the fans. And in terms of being able to recognize a drop in the quality of play, people can't tell that. People watch a hockey game. Everyone looks the same to most people. They're not like, they don't have this nuanced eye for what's happening out there. They can't see a baseball game and think, oh, the pitcher really has his breaking ball today. People can't tell things like that when you get to the level of professional athletes where there's so little separation. It's not like watching the Pee Wee hockey game or the Pop Warner football game. So, and in terms of the predictability, I don't know. It was pretty predictable. The Lakers won. The Tampa Bay Lightning won. I could have told you they were going to win. The Chiefs were there in the Super Bowl. A lot of people predicted that. Tom Brady going to another Super Bowl wasn't exactly like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that actually happened. So I'm not really sure. The Dodgers, I mean, they were the odds-on favorite to walk away.
Well, I don't mean predictability in that sense. Perhaps more reliability of having a consistent schedule that doesn't change at a moment's notice, knowing that your favorite players are going to be there unless there's an injury, and then all of a sudden seven of them are quarantined for a week and a half. And I think it's not, to me, it's not a coincidence that if football had the smallest drop-off, that was also the sport that stayed the closest to its normal format.
It's also the least nuanced in terms of the viewing experiences of the sports. Like, I think football is something that is in these 3 or 4 second bite-sized happenings, right, with the way a play happens. Whereas with hockey, for instance, there's flow. And baseball has done what it's done to itself with the whole three pure outcome scenarios, and that sport needs to change. But basketball had the big drop-off, and yes, football had the Sundays and all of that, but we've become, as we've devolved, a football-centric nation because it's a sort of simple, it's not actually simple in terms of the coaching of football, but what we're visually presented in terms of what we can understand. It's like the whole thing with Romo. He predicts these plays. Well, anyone who knows the sport can look at how everyone's aligned and kind of get an idea for what's going to happen, but that's so few people. We need to feel like, you have people on Twitter that have like 3.2 million followers. And they can go on Twitter and they can say, I bought a roll of paper towels today. And they'll spell all of the words wrong and they'll write law at the end of it. And people will love that. People don't actually love that that person tweeted that they bought a roll of paper towels. They love because we are so insecure and so devoid of our own interests and our own identities. They love being in ensconced in the middle of that group womb. That's what people need right now. There's so little individual predilection. And even before, 15 years ago, you turn on the TV and it's an Edmonton-LA Kings game and it's like 11:30 at night. You're watching that game and no one else in the country is watching it, really. You're watching that because you love that sport. You're not doing something. You're partaking of something. And we've lost the ability to partake of things. We follow and we do. And it's very different than partaking.
Well, and I think that's the whole allure of social media, is feeling an attachment, feeling part of something larger than yourself. And you know, there might be more payoff to that in the world of social media, where at least you might get a response occasionally from some quasi-famous person that you follow. And I'm not sure that the world of professional sports has given back much to fans in recent years.
That's the illusion of relationship. That's what's killing us. That's not anything that's providing succor to somebody. That is simulacrum. That's not reality. That's fantasy, and not the fantasy of I'm going to read some Tolkien right now. That's unhealthy. That's replaced real relationships and real friendships and vulnerability and romance. That's not where we want to go as a healthy society. That's where we go as a devolving society of a kind of mass walking dead. That's why people are so unwell right now, and they're not using it for information, and they're not using it to foster connectivity. They're using it to, it's the new opiate of the masses. It's not, So I think that's why people also, I mean, you see this everywhere, but I think sports is just one more result of that. And I bet you when the fans come back and people can have that kind of glommed on faux experience, you'll see the ratings go up again. Maybe not for baseball because it's kind of a lost cause until it changes, but they'll go right back up.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Dantana. From sports, we move to the 50th anniversary of a television classic, Norman Lear's All in the Family, that premiered 50 years ago and is still considered one of the greatest and most influential television shows in history, largely because of the lead character, Archie Bunker, who you say was was not as bad as perhaps people remember.
I know. It sounds like a weird thing, the way he's talked about now, to mount a defense for Archie Bunker. But I've come to learn that people are faceted. They're simple, but they're faceted. And what I mean by that is we know almost every single person we know via one single facet, the way they present themselves to us. Like you see, for instance, these horrible bigoted people in publishing that I deal with. That same person, though, goes out and picks their kid up from school, and the mother who watches them cinch up the child's jacket thinks that's a really great parent. Now, you see what's going on. You know them for what they are. But that person who observes that, they know them for a different thing. Now, it's a false thing, and it's not like the overriding character thrust of who they are. I know what that is. But everyone gets like a facet. And so the facet with Archie Bunker that we see and that has lived on in the popular cultural memory is of the bigot. But he's a doting father, clearly, with the whole little girl thing. And the person who loves him the most is, by any metric, in Edith, a truly good person, right? Mm. But we don't stop to think through these progressions anymore. We just see a word or a way something is expressed, and that becomes the way we rubber stamp your character. Even though we might not have any character, we probably don't, of our own. And also, he's a great example of how almost everyone is a product of their environment. There is hardly anyone who has ever existed in the history of humankind who says, no, I step out from this crowd and I go my way. Those people are often crucified and they have difficult lives and all these other things. Some of them start revolutions, and that's great. But a lot of times, you're just a product of your environment. And Archie Bunker, if you know the character in that show, was raised in not a great home space with a father who would hit him, who was bigoted himself, and this sort of like lunkhead who does have a large heart. What was he going to say? No, I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to be enlightened like he's Descartes or something like that. That's not how reality works.
No, and that was the only way that show, I think, could work, if he were just a one-faceted bigot and that was all you saw, then people would all dislike him and eventually you'd turn away. There had to be some likability. And I know, you know, watching it when it first premiered, I think like a lot of people, you saw elements of your own family in there. And so you understood that there's more to this person than the outrageous things he says. And that's why it worked. And you're absolutely right about Edith, who provided that humanity. Even when you wanted to get mad at Archie, you'd think to yourself, well, God, if that wonderful person, Edith, sees something of value in him, then he must be better than I think.
He's ignorant more than he's hateful. He says yes. The wrong thing. Like that episode where they're being robbed by the two black guys, and he thinks he's talking to them in a way that will provide connectivity. It's ironic, because he doesn't know how not to speak down to them. But he also, at the same time, because they're doing such a good job with their theft, he respects them. He just doesn't know how to shoot that divide, as it were. And I remember, like, one of my grandmothers was really good-hearted and really a great person. She wouldn't know necessarily, like, what the terminology was then, which is different than what terminology is now, which will be different from what terminology is in 6 months from now or 50 years from now, whatever that may be. But he wasn't like this just reprobate. He was someone who was struggling to advance in a world that always felt to him like he was passing him by. And I have news for everyone out there. It's probably comforting for a lot of people. Almost everyone feels that way, no matter their skin color. We all, almost all of us, harbor that fear. Now, it takes like different iterations, but almost every terror. And it's part of the reason why we do the social media, because we do this sort of Dorian Gray thing where it's like, it's not me, it's my picture. Make my picture count, because I have more control over the picture. And when you act like that, cut yourself off from the world, and then here we are. Someone like Archie Bunker becomes this verboten subject that you can't mount any kind of defense for. But he's very much like us, like Chad is. Chad and Archie Bunker, they're very similar to all of us.
We move from Archie Bunker to wonderful writer Ambrose Bierce, who I first discovered, wouldn't you know, through the Twilight Zone. The last episode of the series was a version of an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. You discovered Ambrose Bierce in college, and you were attracted to the fact that he wasn't safe.
No, as you know, and some listeners might know, I hated college. It was just professors telling me that I sucked at writing and giving me Fs. And I was thinking, like, no, this is not how this works. This is the wrong way around. You were the losers who were here doing this. And I was writing professionally when I was 20 and all of that. But part of the reason was also that I would just stop going to class and I'd read people like Ambrose Bierce, who's not taught. And he certainly wasn't taught to me. And I really appreciated the range of his writing. So I recently did this piece on the Devil's Dictionary, which you see come up now and again, because it's this, I don't even really want to call it cynical take on what words really mean. Because cynical suggests to me that you're looking at things in a way that they aren't. Like, I always don't trust people who say, I look at the glass half full. Why don't you just look at the glass for what it is and actually how much is in there? Maybe start with that and go from there. So Ambrose Bierce definitely took that tact in his writing. And he wrote great ghost stories. He is probably the best American ghost story writer. He disappeared into Mexico as like a soldier of fortune of the Mexican Civil War. And he wrote this wonderful book, which had a long sort of gestation period on the road to publication, called The Devil's Dictionary, which is what I wrote about and which is what most people know. But he did so much. He was a reporter, and there wasn't like really a style of poet that of writing that he wouldn't do. And nowadays, people will be like, you have to do a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche and facilitate all of us becoming morons. And Ambrose Bierce would have been like, no, screw that.
Colin's piece about Ambrose Bierce is in the Smart Set. Find it online, thesmartset.com. And one of the things you say about Bierce is that you're either all in or you're running in the other direction from his work. Why is that?
I think, for me, stylistically, there's an aridness, I would say, to his prose. It has the quality of peanut brittle, and people who eat peanut brittle know that, like, you either really like peanut brittle or you're like, this is like shards of glass sort of caramelized and I'm not interested in this. I'd say Bierce is the writing version of that at times. There's a certain inflexibility in his prose manner. It's very witty. Someone like John Lennon would enjoy reading Ambrose Bierce. Never did, but he would have enjoyed it, I think. And he also, I mean, but again, I don't want to suggest that this is something, I'm not someone who ascribes to the whole we can't read lots of books and someone can't be read by millions of people doing great work. I just can't think that way because that would run counter to everything that I'm trying to bring about. But I think Bierce presents sometimes for people not just truths that are hard to hear, which I think people can accept, but he does it in a kind of like, boom, blow that up in your face kind of way. And then he gives a fist bump standing over you and like sort of like micturates on you and then walks off. So I like that kind of thing personally, but other people could be like, oh no, he's being too real. I don't like this.
What is it about Bierce that from your perspective makes him better at terror than H.P. Lovecraft?
Oh, he's so much better than Lovecraft. Lovecraft has, there's an amazing divide between Lovecraft's best stories. There aren't that many. And M.R. James was a little bit this way, too, but he's a better writer than Lovecraft. Lovecraft just, he's so turgid at times in the pomposity and the grandiloquence. And you see it even just when he's spelling everything like color with the English U. And he's just so into these words that's like, you can take this out, take this out, you can take this out. It's not adding to mood. It's not adding to atmosphere. It's not adding to plot. It's not adding to characterization. What Ambrose Bierce does is he does not waste any movement going from A to B. And it doesn't mean that his stories are simple, but he also has better ideas for his stories than Lovecraft did. And he can take a story that might seem like, oh, okay, why didn't I think of that? And we've spoken of that before. He does why didn't I think of that kind of stories, where you just want to have written it yourself. And the image is both complex, but it stays with you in this simple, primal, id-based way. And I think that's just something that so few people who have written have ever had. And Bierce had that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. We wrap it up with a discussion of what I think you could easily make a case for being the song that built country music, the Carter Family's Can the Circle Be Unbroken from 1935.
This is the good country music. This isn't the country music of yee-haw, let's drink in a parking lot. Not that. This is artful country music. And it's also this song, I was thinking about this, it's kind of America's version of Danny Boy, wouldn't you say?
I would.
Because I think it impacts people on this emotional level that is, again, so intense because it's so real. And I have, I know we don't do hot takes here, but I have a correct take to blow minds. Maybelle Carter is the greatest guitarist this country has ever produced.
Yeah, you know what? I there are a lot of people who would agree with you on that. She certainly revolutionized the instrument.
She did, and she did what Robert Johnson also did, and sort of around the same time, where if you listen to Robert Johnson, the wow factor of Robert Johnson's guitar playing is that it sounds like it's more than two hands. It sounds like there are, you know how you can have like four people at the piano or something like that. Robert Johnson played guitar that way. So does Maybelle Carter. She plays lead and rhythm at the same time, which is just one of those musical quirks of physics that should not be possible, but which is possible. And you can hear it again and again, going back to their earliest recordings from summer of 1927. It's just such Baroque country music, and yet at the same time, it's rustic and organic and as real as the dirt under your feet. It's just as powerful. It gives me hope that we don't have to suck at everything. This is something that's popular and it's beautiful, and some of it's as sophisticated as what Johann Sebastian Bach was doing, and it's there. This is the real country music, all you people with your fireball and your arena parking lot.
Well, hope is an interesting word because I give a lot of credit for the success of this song to A.P. Carter, who often got overshadowed by Mother Maybelle and Sarah Carter, but it was A.P. who took this old hymn that was usually sung at funerals and switched it around enough to make it a song of hope and not despair.
You know what goes a long way in doing that, too? And most cover versions you hear of this song leave this out. But next time, Downtownians, you're listening to this song, just go play it on YouTube after hearing this segment. No, I'm sorry, after the end of the
after
show.
After 6 o'clock, yes, thank you.
go listen to it on YouTube. You'll hear them skip a beat. And it's on the words there and there, by and by. It's this move that it's a form of music that's not around anymore. It gives it this kind of like jump. There's this actual bump in the music every time, by and by. Like they skip that beat, which is a really strange but like surprising and awesome and fitting thing to do. And it gives the song this rhythmic propulsion that is you just wouldn't expect to have with this sort of threnody song, because that's what it really was, like you said.
Colin Fleming with us every Tuesday on Downtown. If you haven't read it yet, what the hell are you waiting for? Get your hands on Meathead's Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Read Colin's piece on Ambrose Bierce at thesmartset.com and keep your eyes peeled because he is the most published man on planet Earth with good reason. Colin, thank you much. We'll see you next week.
All right, send me that that photo of the tattoo again, like you
said. It's on the way. And for your eyes only.